looked more closely to figure out what they were.
Here.
She set a jingling object on the plate in front of him. Grimshaw held it up to get a better look. The silver charms on the bracelet were all musical instruments. Harp, piano, violin, trumpet, guitar, drum, saxophone. They jingled when he moved his hand, and they shone when they caught the light.
Perfect.
Paige gave Osgood a mischievous smile.
See, I told you it was a good choice.
She took the plate and left the dining room, presumably to tell Inike that the guests were ready for breakfast. Grimshaw tucked the charm bracelet into his shirt pocket, put the lid back on the box, picked up his coffee, and waited.
When I was picked for the initial assignment, Detective Swin said to pack an overnight bag.
Osgood said.
His team drove up in the two cars, so I didn't have a vehicle to drive over to the communities around Crystal Lake to look for the things you wanted. Miss Page said she was going to the yard sale. I guess one of the Xaviers does that once a week to look for things that might be useful in the boarding house, or to sell on to someone else. I said I could go with her. She even made the extra trip to Putney so that I could pick up more clothes and my own car, in case you needed me to run another errand. But I didn't talk about the case.
Grimshaw was certain the baby cop believed that. He was equally certain Paige Xavier, like the other women in her family, was an expert at extracting information without seeming to do anything at all. Paige returned and set the plates in front of them, omelets and toast, and a small bowl of sliced seasonal fruit. She topped off Grimshaw's coffee, then left the room.
No prunes?
Not that he minded. He was just curious and wanted to verify the potential of Osgood as a gossip magnet.
Maxwell has a tender tummy after the episode yesterday, so Miss Inike didn't want to tempt him.
Osgood bit into a strawberry.
I'd rather have the fresh stuff.
He focused on eating for a minute. Detective Swin and Detective Reynolds are gone, but I think they're coming back.
Not a surprise.
I'm going to the jumble to retrieve that piece of evidence. I want you to patrol Main Street and then man the phones at the office. Pay attention to anything being said about the bank. If it's going to close for good, or will reopen under a new owner.
Like the Sanguinati?
Osgood asked. Grimshaw nodded.
Don't push for information. Just pay attention to what the people around you are saying.
He finished his breakfast and pushed away from the table.
I shouldn't be long, but I'll call in if I have to stop anywhere else.
Yes, sir.
Grimshaw tapped the top of the shoebox.
Take that to the station and tuck it in an empty drawer. You never know when we'll need another shiny bribe.
Getting out of the cruiser, Grimshaw touched the metal of Mikos under his shirt before he unhooked the chain across the jumble's access road and lowered it to the ground. He didn't see anything, not even a sparrow or chipmunk, but he could feel the Terra Indigene watching him as he drove his car past the boundary and stopped to hook up the chain, cutting off his chance of a fast escape. He hoped the others would understand the action to mean he had nothing to fear from them because he offered no threat to Vicky Devine or any other resident of the jumble. Whether they understood or not, nothing prevented him from reaching the main house. But something had warned Vicky that she was about to have a visitor because she opened the front door and stepped outside before he had time to get out of the car.
Miss Devine.
Officer Grimshaw.
Aggie rushed up, wearing a mesh beach cover-up and nothing else. She latched onto one of Vicky's hands. Grimshaw wasn't sure who was supposed to be protecting whom.
Why is he here? What does he want?
Aggie asked.
Should I call Cougar?
If you think he could help with this problem.
Grimshaw replied. He'd skimmed a couple of cop and crime stories last evening, as well as reading a piece of the novel by Alan Wolfgard. He considered himself a good cop, a man who believed in the code of serve and protect. But he'd realized last night that it would take more than being a good cop if he wanted to deal with some of the others. He had to present himself as the kind of cop they would recognize as good. Trouble was,
if he started representing himself as a persona rather than the person he was. At some point, he would slip up, and he didn't think the others ever forgave or forgot deceit. But that didn't mean he couldn't adapt a few things from the books and TV shows Vicky and Aggie might use as reference for dealing with the police during this investigation. "You want to talk to Cougar?" Vicky asked. Of course not. No one in his right mind wanted to talk to one of the Panther Guard, or the Bear Guard, for that matter, or the Sanguinati.
"If you think he could help."
Grimshaw pushed his hat back, a look that conveyed country friendliness. Sometimes people in the wild country needed help, and looking as official as possible made them feel easy. Sometimes looking a little more friendly made it easier for them to trust the man as well as the uniform.
"I guess it depends on the problem," Vicky said.
"A piece of evidence wasn't collected the other day when Detective Swin's team caused a fuss here while you were helping the police with their inquiries."
Vicky Devine raised her eyebrows, but said nothing.
"A tie clip wasn't bagged with the rest of Detective Baker's personal effects, which means it fell off when the body was collected."
Grimshaw pointed to the area where Baker's body had been twisted.
"Right around there."
He focused on the two females.
"It is possible that someone picked it up, thinking it wasn't significant. A pretty bauble that no one would miss. But it is an important piece of evidence, and we really need it returned."
Grimshaw took the charm bracelet out of his pocket and held it up, spreading it open over his fingers so they could see the charms.
"Oh!"
Her dark eyes bright with excitement, Aggie released Vicky's hand and reached for the bracelet. Grimshaw pulled his hand back just enough so that she couldn't grab the bracelet and run away. Aggie gave him a look that held a touch of menace. She might be young, and she wasn't one of the forms of Terra Indigene that would be lethal as individuals, not like a panther or bear or wolf. But he didn't think calling a gathering of crows a murderer was a designation someone made up just for the fun of it. And a gathering of the Crow Guard certainly could be a danger to a single human.
"I'm willing to trade this bracelet, which a young woman could wear as well as admire, for the tie clip Detective Baker was wearing when he came to the jumble the other day."
"A lot of people could bring you tie clips in order to get the shiny,"
Aggie said, her eyes still focused on the charm bracelet.
"How would you know which one belonged to that man?"
"I'm a cop. I'll know."
Aggie looked at Vicky in mute appeal. "An experienced police officer would know, just like the investigator in the story we watched the other night," Vicky said. Aggie sighed. Then she pulled the beach cover-up over her head, giving Grimshaw a look at physical quirks that he didn't want or need to know about. Moments later, she shifted into her crow form and flew away.
"You think Aggie took the tie clip?" Vicky said.
"Someone here pulled the tie out from under the body and took the clip," Grimshaw replied. "If it wasn't Aggie, then I'd bet a month's wages that it was one of her kin."
"You really need it for the investigation? Why?"
"Because Detective Swin was very upset about its disappearance, and I want to know what's so special about that particular tie clip."
They fell into an awkward silence. She seemed reluctant to be around him. And not because he was a cop. She was acting like someone had painted an insulting remark about her on a public wall, making her the focus of unhappy attention, and he was one of the people who had read it. Before he could decide if he should say anything about the fireplug remark Swin had made, Aggie returned. She landed on the wide arm of the chair near the front door and dropped the tie clip she carried in her beak. She nudged it this way and that until the tie clip was resting on the front edge of the arm, right in a narrow beam of sunlight that showed the clip to best advantage. Grimshaw set the charm bracelet on the arm and scooped up the tie clip. Aggie grabbed the bracelet and flew off. Bargain set and sealed. He looked at the tie clip and frowned, unable to see why Swin had gone into conniptions about its loss. Okay. Everything from a crime scene should be bagged, but he didn't think that was the reason Swin had reacted the way he did. Then he caught the look on Vicky Devine's face.
"What is it?"
Yorick has a tie clip like that. He held it up to give her a better look.
Your ex-husband has a tie clip like this, or just similar to this?
She looked at him, her eyes full of confusion.
Exactly like that.
Chapter 22. Vicky. Thursday, June 15th. Sitting in the Jumbles library with Ilya Sanguinati and Officer Grimshaw, I looked at the books I had shelved yesterday and had an epiphany. While I enjoyed reading thrillers, I didn't want to be the girl tangled in the plot of one because I would have been the heroine's best friend or the girl who had fallen for the hero. The girl he felt some affection for because she gave him sex while he was getting over the loss of his one true love. Those were the girls who ended up getting tossed in the wood chipper, or left at the bottom of a deep, dry well full of spiders and millipedes. Said well suddenly refilling, quite inconveniently, so that the girl would be found but not in time, especially if she was the passing love interest of the hero of the story. Those were also the girls who would be tied up in a cave and left to become the frame for a bat guano sculpture. But even the epiphany didn't stop me from snorting out a laugh when Officer Grimshaw floated his theory about the tie clips.
You think Yorick belongs to a secret society? An organization with secret handshakes and code words? A society that, wanting to remain secret, identifies its members by a tie clip? Are you serious?
Apparently he was.
I looked at Ilya Sanguinati to see what he thought about Grimshaw's theory. I don't know if it was because he was a vampire or an attorney, but he had mastered the poker face.
You think it's possible? I said to Ilya.
It should be considered, he replied.
It indicates a connection between Detective Swin and your ex-husband.
Grimshaw leaned toward me, his forearms resting on his thighs, his face full of concerned sincerity.
Think about it. You were married to the man for how many years? Did he belong to any clubs, go out to monthly meetings that were members only?
He picked up an evidence bag containing the tie clip and held it up.
Your ex-husband and at least one of the detectives in a CIU team had this exact tie clip. A Bristol CIU team should have taken the assignment when I reported the suspicious death of Franklin Cartwright on your property. But a team from Putney, led by Marmaduke Swin, showed up instead.
The police in Putney have not concerned themselves with the citizens of Sproing until now,
Ilya Sanguinati said.
Bristol has two CIU teams that are supposed to handle any suspicious deaths or other incidents in Bristol and the area within Bristol's jurisdiction, which includes Lake Silence. Highway Patrol out of Bristol is supposed to handle anything on the roads between Crystal Lake and Lake Silence, and that includes answering calls from Sproing.
Grimshaw's expression hardened.
It was possible that both Bristol teams already had cases and couldn't send anyone that day, but I checked with Captain Hargreaves, and he told me a team had been available. Somehow, Swin heard about Cartwright and claimed jurisdiction, saying it was related to a crime he was already investigating. Since no one in Bristol wanted to fight with Swin over going to Sproing, they let him have the case.
Jeez, I said.
What do you guys do? Play rock, paper, scissors to decide who has to take a call here? I knew the police didn't like coming to Sproing, and to be fair, they had good reason to feel that way. But being told you sometimes got protection from someone like Swin because no one else wanted to come didn't make me feel all warm and fuzzy. Or safe. I don't think I have a good poker face, because Grimshaw looked uncomfortable. Ilya Sanguinati's poker face didn't change. But I had the feeling he might have a few things to say to someone about how humans protected other humans.
Right now, it doesn't matter how Swin got the case, Grimshaw said. What matters is why he wanted it.
That man, Franklin Cartwright, Ilya said. Did he have one of those tie clips?
I don't know, Grimshaw replied. He was dressed casually when he was found. Swin's team collected his things from the boarding house.
So now we had a conspiracy? This was getting better and better. Or worse and worse. I raked my fingers through my hair, dislodging some of the clips that kept it under control. Ilya Sanguinati looked at my springing hair. His poker face cracked. His lips twitched. I promised myself that I would cover all the mirrors until I ran a brush through my hair so that I wouldn't scare myself. We won't talk about the time I got a brush so tangled in my hair I had to make an emergency appointment with my stylist and have her perform a brushectomy to avoid having brush head for the rest of my life. How many secret societies can there be? I loved the question, not expecting an answer.
Since they're a secret, it's anyone's guess,
Grimshaw replied. His eyes went blank. I watched him swallow. We had momentarily forgotten that one of us was not like the others. Now neither of us looked at the vampire in the room. The human's first and last movement hadn't been a secret. It had been a political pro-human, anti-others group that started with speeches and ended with the acts of violence that started the war that killed a lot of people in Thasia and destroyed the Kel-Romano Alliance of Nations on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. But secret societies with secret agendas that might pose a threat to the Terra Inagene? I had a bad feeling Grimshaw and I had just painted targets on the backs of several people, including my ex-husband. York used to say a successful businessman was bound to make a few enemies. I don't think he'd considered that the Sanguinati might be one of them when he said that.
It may not be a secret society, I said.
It could be a private or exclusive group that doesn't want their name splashed in the newspapers for doing charitable work. Or it could be a club. York was a member of a couple of clubs where he hobnobbed with people who had money or social clout. Those clubs were exclusive, but they weren't secret.
Grimshaw nodded. That would make more sense. Although I doubt that Marmaduke Swin or Franklin Cartwright had money or the social clout to belong to such a club.
It doesn't matter if Detective Swin and Franklin Cartwright are part of that group, Ilya said. It doesn't change the fact that humans with an agenda are causing trouble at the jumble. Until we know who belongs to this tie-clip club, we cannot determine if they are merely a nuisance or a real threat.
I had a feeling that everyone who was included in the we Ilya Sanguinati referred to had fangs at the very least, which meant we didn't include Grimshaw and me.
It's a human investigation,
Grimshaw said, turning in his seat to look directly at Ilya.
It's a human investigation because Victoria called the police instead of calling us,
Ilya replied.
Oh, golly.
Had I stepped on some Terra Inagene toes by reporting the body to humans instead of calling Silence Lodge? Of course, I hadn't known about the jumble being a Terra Inagene settlement, or even the species of my neighbors across the lake, so I hope the Sanguinati took that into account. Franklin Cartwright was staying at the boarding house, and he allegedly worked for Yorick, I said, trying to smooth any ruffled feathers, or fangs. Even if I hadn't called the police when Aggie tried to warm up the eyeball in the wave cooker, someone would have noticed that he disappeared. I liked saying allegedly. It was such a cop and crime word.
Humans disappear in the wild country all the time.
Grimshaw looked grim. I didn't blame him. We were being reminded that survival not only depended on fellow humans playing nice and sharing the sandbox, but also depended on not bringing yourself to the attention of all the large, intelligent predators that prowled just beyond the boundary of the sandbox, and sometimes went hunting inside the sandbox when they had a reason to focus on particular prey.
You should ask the Xaviers, I said, breaking the tense silence that followed Ilya's words.
Detective Swin, his team, and the dead man had stayed at the boarding house. If any of them had one of those tie clips, Inike might have seen it. I pointed to the tie clip in the evidence bag. You could show her that one, or even take a photo of it to show around. It was the way Grimshaw didn't look at me that told me someone, or several someones, had already asked Inike about the tie clip. The Xaviers are not the only individuals who could assist in finding out who wears that symbol, Ilya said, focusing a predator stare on Grimshaw. We can assist with locating other humans who belong to this group. You can supply a photo. Vampire and cop locked eyes.
Belonging to an organization isn't proof of guilt or collusion, Grimshaw said.
But obtaining a sample of who might belong to a particular group may assist in determining the group's agenda, Ilya countered. After a weighty silence, he added, Our interest is in understanding why Franklin Cartwright came to the jumble and what he was supposed to achieve. Victoria is the owner of the buildings and caretaker of the land that makes up the jumble. Someone thinks otherwise and is causing trouble. We will pursue this until we know why. We are willing to work with the police in this matter, or we will work on our own.
In other words, someone can go to jail if he or she has been naughty, or that person can be eaten. Given those choices, I'm pretty sure I would choose jail. Then again, Ilya Sanguinati did look yummy, and dying from orgasms and blood loss might not be a bad way to go.
Cooperation is always appreciated.
Grimshaw didn't sound like he appreciated being backed into a corner, but he said the words that should at least delay more people getting killed. But I was going to pay close attention to the shelves in the general store in case there was a sudden run on the ketchup and hot sauce. Chapter 23 Aggie Thursday, June 15th Following Ilya Sanguinati's orders, Aggie gathered her Crowguard kin and flew to the woodland side of Silence Lodge, where they wouldn't be seen by any humans fishing on the lake. Many of the crows chose to perch on the branches of nearby trees, but most settled on the ground, since it was easier to shift to a human form when you didn't have to balance on a branch that might not hold that shape. A dozen Sanguinati followed Miss Vicky's attorney out of the lodge. Several crows fluffed and fluttered. Other crows preened their feathers to show they weren't concerned by the number of vampires who were also attending this meeting. Normally, the Crow Guard had no reason to fear the Sanguinati. Being another form of Terra Indigene, they were not prey. But powerful predators should never be taken lightly.
We would like your assistance in solving a puzzle, Ilya Sanguinati said.
Aggie stopped preening. Puzzles were fun, especially the ones that required figuring out how to claim a shiny. Ilya Sanguinati held out a photograph of the shiny clip thing she had traded for the pretty bracelet.
We need to find out how many humans have a tie clip exactly like this one. Once we know who they are, we'll be able to find out why they are interested in the jumble.
Miss Vicky is taking care of the jumble now, Eddie Crowguard said. She is the reader. We don't need another human there.
We think the humans who wear this clip are trying to force Miss Vicky to leave.
Peck them! Tell Cougar to claw them! Tell the bear to swat them!
Not yet.
All the crows settled down. Not yet wasn't quite a promise that soon there would be eyeballs for lunch, but it was close.
You cannot take these shinies, Ilya Sanguinati said. They have to stay with the humans who own them.
Aggie stared at Ilya. No shinies? What kind of puzzle game was that?
Find something else to bring back that will tell me who the humans are and where they live, Ilya said. Something they won't miss, like mail humans toss in the recycle box as soon as it arrives, or an envelope that has been thrown out. We need something with the human's name and address.
What happens then? Aggie asked.
She wasn't sure how many of the crows would play this puzzle game if they couldn't bring back any shinies. Ilya smiled, showing his fangs.
Then we'll be able to identify the human enemies hiding among the rest.
Chapter 24 Grimshaw Thursday, June 15th
Inike Xavier walked into the boarding house's parlor, wearing a one-piece bathing suit and an open robe.
You wanted to see me?
When Grimshaw didn't answer, she looked amused. He understood her amusement and felt grateful that she was amused because he couldn't stop looking at her thighs. Or more precisely, the two tattoos on her thighs. On her left thigh was a revolver. The smoke coming out of the barrel rose toward her nether region. On her right thigh was a big-eyed caricature of Inike with her multicolored hair piled on top of her head and a miniature of the boarding house tucked in the hair like an ornament. Around the caricature's neck was a necklace made of tombstones, and beneath them were the words, I bury trouble.
Gods,
Grimshaw thought.
I'm renting a room from this woman.
Inike closed the robe, releasing Grimshaw from his involuntary fixation with the tattoos.
Will this take long?
Inike asked.
I'm going to the jumble to talk to Vicky about our arrangements to offer guests a guided trail ride to the lake. I think she needs some girl time, and I could use a swim while we review the details.
Grimshaw wanted to shake his head to clear it, or at least splash some cold water on his face. But that would tell her too much about his reaction. Was there something mesmerizing about those tattoos? Something hypnotic? Or was it just that he'd been caught unprepared? He needed to close this case and get out of Sproing. He held out the photo of the tie clip.
Have you seen this?
Have I seen a tie clip? I imagine every man has one, so I've seen plenty of them over the years. I think I even have a couple of them in the secondary jewelry box.
He hoped she had bought them for herself, and he didn't have to look for bodies in the compost bin.
I'm looking for tie clips exactly like this one.
I've covered this ground before.
But she took the photo and studied the image. Unless someone's behavior gives me a reason to look, I don't rummage through my guests' possessions. That doesn't mean I don't pay attention to anything that's left out in plain sight. Being tidy men, I can't say if you or Officer Osgood have a tie clip like this. Franklin Cartwright had rented one of the ensuite rooms, but he didn't leave out so much as a tube of toothpaste. And despite planning to be here for a few days, he didn't remove anything from his luggage but a couple of shirts and a second pair of trousers that he hung in the closet. And his luggage was always locked when he left his room.
How could you tell?
The luggage was secured with leather straps and padlocks. Inike handed back the photo.
I don't mind guests having secrets or wearing the perfume of mystery. We all have secrets, and everyone should have a little mystery in their lives.
But those padlocks and his talk about Vicky squatting at the jumble when we'd all watched her pump money and sweat into the place didn't sit right. If Cartwright hadn't been killed, I was going to tell him to find another place to stay.
There isn't another place to stay in Sproing.
She gave him a predatory smile.
Exactly.
She waved a hand at the photo. Detective Reynolds and Baker had a tie clip like that. So did Detective Swin.
What about the bank manager?
Inike narrowed her eyes.
I never had a reason to pay attention, so I can't say for sure.
Thanks for your help.
Grimshaw started to turn away, then stopped. Inike picked up a large straw basket that held a rolled beach towel, a bottle of water, and a small purse.
Something else?
He hesitated, then decided to ask the question.
What do you think will happen if Vicky Devine leaves the jumble?
I think that will depend on why she leaves.
Do I look like I wear a tie?
Grimshaw looked up at Gershwin Jones, the owner of Grace Notes, Sproing's store for all things musical. Looking up at someone was a novel experience he didn't enjoy.
No, you don't,
Grimshaw replied.
But I'm asking business owners if they've seen a tie clip like this.
Gershwin Jones was a large, well-proportioned man, a first-generation Thasian whose parents had emigrated from the Eastern Storm Islands. He had brown skin and dark eyes. He wore his dark hair in dreadlocks that fell below his shoulder blades, and the knee-length caftan he wore over sand-colored trousers looked like a rainbow that had overdosed on caffeine.
All the business owners, or a select few?
Like Julian Farrow, Gershwin Jones was a newcomer, someone who had moved to Sproing last fall, after so many people in small, isolated places like this one had died or bolted to towns that were human-controlled, or at least provided more of an illusion that there was a boundary between them and the Terra Indigene. Grimshaw might not sense things like Julian did, but a cop had his own kind of intuition.
A select few. The people who moved into the area within the past year. Lots of people have been looking for new opportunities, looking for a different place to settle down. You've got simple life folk running the livery, and I understand that a few Intuits have become residents of Sproing. And I think you're one of them, he added silently.
Jones went over to the bins of sheet music and began straightening the already tidy bins.
Julian says you're a friend of his. Says you're open-minded about the gifts that come to a person at birth.
Which just confirmed his thought that Jones was an Intuit.
I try to be open-minded about things that don't hurt another person or break the law.
Jones just kept tidying the bins. Finally, he stopped, but didn't look at Grimshaw.
I have a feeling the men who wear that tie clip wouldn't be doing business with someone like me. They don't feel the rhythm of a place or the people who live there. They don't have a feel for anything but profit. You hear what I'm saying? Those detectives causing trouble for Miss Vicky, they didn't come in. But Officer Osgood has come in to look at the sheet music. Look at the instruments I have for sale. He feels the rhythm.
Well, asking people about the tie clips had been a long shot. A faraway look came into Jones's eyes. Then he focused on Grimshaw.
You got a connection to any of the special girls?
For a moment, Grimshaw's body clenched. Special girls. Blood prophets. The Cassandra sang. Girls who could see the future when their skin was cut.
No, I don't have a connection to any of those girls,
he said. Not directly, anyway. Some of the girls still lived in the compounds where they had been raised and trained. Others had left that benevolent ownership and tried to survive in the chaotic everyday world. Many hadn't survived, and the ones who had were hidden away. If you wanted to hide vulnerable girls, you'd ask someone who had an intuitive sense about a place to find communities where those girls would be safe. And Grimshaw didn't know anyone who was better at sensing a place than Julian Farrow.
Thanks for your help, Grimshaw said.
He hurried out of Grace Notes and went straight to Lettuce Reed.
You alone?
He asked Julian as he walked into the store.
For the moment. Julian replied. Had a run on romantic suspense novels an hour ago. Probably not the type of story that is of interest to you.
Grimshaw waved off the comment.
I need help answering a question. I need a special kind of help.
Too cryptic? No. Julian knew exactly what, or who, he was talking about, and said nothing. Expecting that to be Julian's response, he added,
I know a man who knows a man who might know a blood prophet.
Julian looked away.
What are we playing? 6 degrees of separation or connect the dots? Maybe both. What do detectives working in Putney, a bank manager in Sproing, and a businessman living in Hubney have in common? You tell me. They all have the same tie clip, which could be coincidence or could be a connection.
Julian said nothing.
Grimshaw decided to push. You helped hide some of those girls, didn't you? Before you opened the store here. We're not talking about it. Ever.
Julian said fiercely. No. Julian wouldn't talk. Blood prophets were worth a fortune because of their ability to see the future. And a man who admitted that he knew where to find even one of them would be wearing a target on his back. But there was one blood prophet who might be within reach.
Captain Hargreaves knows a patrol captain in Lakeside. Might be able to reach out.
He didn't want to ask Hargreaves to call in another favor on his behalf. but he also didn't want this trouble at the jumble to be the incident that started the next great predation.
Do you really need this?
Gershwin Jones seems to think I do. He's the one who asked if I knew any of the special girls. A crackling silence. Finally, Julian sighed.
Some Intuits have a private information exchange. There's been talk that some of the special girls are exploring ways to reveal prophecy without their skin being cut.
He smiled grimly.
I know a man who knows a wolf, who knows a girl who might be able to answer a question by reading cards. If you could reach out, Grimshaw said. I trust Captain Hargreaves, but Swin's involvement raises the question of who else might be connected to this mess. Work out exactly what you want to ask, and I'll send the question. Might help if I can email the photo of the tie clip, too. Thanks. I'll be back.
Grimshaw crossed the street and went inside the police station. Osgood was there, reading one of the books he'd purchased at Let Us Read.
Why don't you do a foot patrol?
Grimshaw said. He pulled out his wallet and handed Osgood a couple of bills.
Pick up some lunch for the two of us while you're out and about.
Yes, sir.
Osgood hesitated.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to take some alone time to consider a question.
Chapter 25. Vicky. Fires Day, June 16th.
We were trapped in a building. Lots of pipes overhead and exposed steel support beams. Something was in there with us, hunting us. We'd found Dominic Xavier lying in a pool of her own blood, her blank eyes staring at us as we turned and ran, searching for a way out, desperate to escape the monster. Inike, Paige, and I fled in the same direction. As I swung around a corner, I heard Paige scream. I turned back, but Inike shouted,
"Run, Vicky, run! Get help!"
Then came a sound that couldn't come from one of us. I ran through a maze of rooms, gray metal walls, metal ceiling, wood floor. My heart pounded. My lungs struggled to breathe. Had to get out. Had to find help.
The next room had baskets of bright-colored toys filling a row of metal tables. Little bits of plastic no bigger than a thumb in the shape of animals. In a world reduced to metallic gray, the colors were startling, unnerving, life-affirming. I picked up a basket and heard a sound behind me. I don't know what it was. It was human-shaped, but nothing human. The head rising from a soiled white shirt and thin striped brown suit looked like papier-mâché draped with dirty stripes of gauze that settled around its shoulders. Instead of eyes, a pair of black goggles were somehow attached to the gauze. Not tight, not like there were straps holding them on to provide some shape to the white lump. It was as if the goggles were its eyes. Several tie clips decorated the lapels of the suit. I flung the plastic toys out of the basket, scattering them over the floor like wash water. The gauze-headed thing stumbled over the plastic bits, just a moment of unbalance. I dropped the empty basket, grabbed another that was full of the colored toys, and ran. Pursued by the terrible thing that was dressed like a businessman, but was deadly and monstrous. I heard a ding, saw the freight elevator's doors open. If I could get to the elevator, I could get to the ground floor. Get out. Get help. Paige was hurt. No one screamed that way if they weren't hurt. And I didn't know what had happened to Inike. I looked back, and it was there, right there, coming toward me. Did I have time to get in the elevator and press the button? Would the elevator doors close before that thing reached them? And me? I threw the basket at it, but the basket turned into a pillow that bounced off its chest. I leaped into the elevator, slapped at the panel, and pushed the B button. Wrong button! There were bad things in the basement. There were always bad things in the basement. I pushed the button for the ground floor, The gauze-headed thing reached in as the elevator doors began to close. Reached in to grab me, to drag me back into something unspeakable. I flung myself to the side of the compartment, desperate to avoid that touch, and I woke up on the floor next to my bed, my heart pounding and a sharp pain above my left eye, surrounded by a sense of ow and a trickle of something wet. It took a couple of tries to get to my feet. I wobbled my way to the bathroom, turned on the light, and stared at the blood trickling from the area above the corner of my left eyebrow. That was so not good, especially when I could see the swelling already starting. I rinsed a washcloth in cold water and applied it to the wound as I studied my face in the mirror. Did my eyes look weird? I didn't feel like I banged my head against anything, but I'd obviously hit something on my way to the floor. I lowered the washcloth and leaned closer to the mirror. The bleeding had stopped for the moment, revealing a couple of scrapes and a shallow gouge surrounded by swelling and shades of purple. Wow. As I dabbed antibiotic ointment on the scrape and covered it with a small bandage, it occurred to me that I would never feel the same when the hero in a story got hit in the face during a fight, because faces really object to getting hit or hurt in any way and didn't hold back when it came to letting you know about it. Back in the bedroom, I turned on the light and wiped up the drops of blood that had fallen on the floor. The culprit, the square corner of the bedside table, didn't have any obvious forensic evidence, but I wiped it off anyway. Having done whatever I could do, I shut off the light and lay diagonally on the bed, my head as far from the table as possible. I entertained my mini-anxiety attack by wondering if I should stay awake in case I had a concussion, which seemed unlikely, and by wondering how Terra Indigene bears and panthers reacted to minor blood spillage. I fell asleep while trying out different versions of how to explain this to Aggie. Chapter 26. Aggie. Fire's Day, June 16th. At first light, the Crow Guard, who lived around Lake Silence, flew to the houses in Sproing for the treasure hunt. It wasn't garbage day, so the trash cans weren't at the curb. But it was the day when the recycling truck traveled the streets for paper, plastic, and glass. An hour later, when humans were stirring and beginning to notice the crows, most of the Crow Guard flew away, bored and disappointed. Better to perch near the businesses and watch the humans and see if any of them wore the shiny that the Sanguinati wanted to find. Determined to find something, Aggie flew to the house that belonged to the human who used to work at the bank. The houses were bigger on this street, and sometimes the humans here discarded things that weren't even broken. Just so she could say she'd been thorough, in case that was something the Sanguinati would reward, she poked through several recycling bins before she reached the bank human's house and perched on the first recycling bin. Glass jars, plastic jugs, nothing interesting. She hopped flat to the paper recycling bin. The crows couldn't get inside the houses to look for shinies, and paper wasn't interesting unless it was a book that had a story. Most of the humans in Sproing brought books to let us read, but sometimes Julian Farrow put books into the recycling bin because pages were missing or the book was falling apart. Sometimes, if there were several stories in the book, most of them would be intact. The Terra Indigene rescued some of those books, willing to skip the stories that had missing pieces and read the ones that were complete. Would the bank human throw away books? Probably, and not because they were old and broken. He would do it because he was that kind of human. Movement around the house distracted her for a moment. Poised to fly away if there was danger, Aggie watched dozens of Sproingers take turns hopping up the steps to the bank human's front door and pooping on the stoop. Then they hopped away, letting everyone on the street know their opinion of the human who lived there. Air ruffled the papers in the recycling bin, and directed the breeze so that the scent of poop blew into the house's open windows. The elementals weren't usually playful or obvious about targeting a particular human, which made Aggie wonder if the Sanguinati had approached that form of Terra Indigene to look for the Tyclips. Discouraged, Aggie almost flew away when a bit of gold shiny caught her eye. She pushed and pecked a few pieces of paper, flinging them out of the bin until she found the envelope that had a logo on the left-hand corner made of metallic gold ink. A small treasure. Maybe useful to the Sanguinati, maybe not. But if the vampires didn't want the envelope, she would keep it. Hearing the front door open and the swearing that followed, Aggie grabbed her prize and flew back to the jumble. Maybe Ilya Sanguinati would trade a different shiny for the envelope, the way Officer Grimshaw had traded the pretty bracelet for the tie clip. Shifting to human form when she reached her little cabin near the lake, Aggie went inside and dressed, choosing casual clothes similar to what she had seen Dominique Xavier wear last week. They both had dark hair, although Aggie's hair was crow black, and Dominique's hair was dark brown. But Aggie figured it was close enough that clothes and colors that Dominique chose would be appropriate, allowing Aggie to blend in with the humans. Blending in was important when approaching humans. She brushed her long black hair and put on the charm bracelet. She couldn't ask the Sanguinati for a reward for finding the bit of shiny paper, but wearing the bracelet would be a hint that, maybe, a reward should be given. Hinting wasn't the same as asking and should be safe. Aggie grabbed the envelope and ran out of the cabin. First, she would show Miss Vicky and also make sure she hadn't missed any clothing she should be wearing. She had studied humans carefully before renting the cabin at the jumble, but sometimes she didn't get the human things quite right. Reaching the screened porch that ran across the back of the main house, Aggie turned the handle on the door and was a little surprised that it was unlocked. But Miss Vicky had planted flowers and did come out early to water them. That must be the reason. Moving silently across the wooden floor, she reached the screen door that opened into the kitchen. She raised her hand to knock, because that would be polite. Then Miss Vicky turned, and Aggie saw the bandage, saw the purple shadows that were on one side of Miss Vicky's face. Aggie backed away from the door. She'd read enough stories to know what bandages and those kinds of shadows meant. She dropped the envelope as she bolted across the screened porch and out, letting the door bang behind her, forgetting that she'd intended to be quiet. No, she should not be quiet. This was bad. So very, very bad. She didn't just send the warning to her Krogard kin. She sent the warning to all the Terra Indigene around Lake Silence.
Somebody attacked Miss Vicky!
Chapter 27. Grimshaw. Firesday, June 16th. Partially dressed, Grimshaw grabbed his mobile phone on the second ring, knowing no one called a cop early unless they needed something.
Grimshaw.
Wayne, get to the jumble, Julian said. Something is happening, and I don't think it's good for any of us. I'm heading there now to see if there's anything I can do.
You have a feeling?
I saw.
Gods, I'm not even sure what I just saw.
A male and female on horses, galloping toward Vicky's place.
A man and woman on horseback doesn't sound serious.
But Julian sounded odd, scared. And that was not good.
The riders weren't human, and despite what the animals looked like, I don't think they were actual horses.
Police officers who worked highway patrol studied every scrap of information they could about the kinds of Terra Indigene they might encounter, and what Julian had just described was among the most dangerous and feared.
Elementals? That would be my guess. I'll be there. Wait for me at the chain. Don't go up to the main house on your own.
Instead of answering, Julian hung up. Swearing fiercely, Grimshaw finished dressing and rushed out of his room and down the stairs.
Coffee's ready,
Paige said with her usual cheer.
We have
no time.
He went past her as Osgood popped out of the dining room.
Sir? Man the phones.
Grimshaw kept going. He yanked open the front door and almost knocked down the bank's former manager.
I want to make a complaint.
The man was red-faced.
Osgood!
Grimshaw shouted.
Deal with this.
He heard indignant whining about being fobbed off to the junior officer, but he ignored it as he ran to his car. He pulled out of the parking lot, spraying gravel. He hit the lights and the siren. He should call for backup. Shouldn't go into this thing blind. He didn't want to bring Osgood. The kid had already had a bad experience at the jumble, and he couldn't be sure Osgood wouldn't freeze if he encountered more Terra Indigene. If he called dispatch for backup, the closest cops around were Swin and Reynolds, and their presence would aggravate the situation, whatever it might be. And gods, if they were dealing with angry elementals, the whole community could be kindling and corpses in the blink of an eye. No, he'd count on Julian Farrell for backup and hope they both survived long enough to get the situation under control before the Terra Indigene took care of things in their own lethal way. Chapter 28. Vicky. Firesday, June 16th. I answered the phone at the same moment a column of smoke flowed through the kitchen screen door and shifted into a very angry attorney. Okay, partially shifted, which raised all kinds of questions about anatomy that I was sure the Sanguinati would never answer.
Vicky? Vicky?
Inike's voice blasted out of the receiver and sounded stressed. I'm not at my best first thing in the morning, and under the circumstances, that was the sum total of my vocabulary.
Something is happening. Grimshaw just peeled out of here like a maniac.
I heard the siren. It was getting closer. Then I heard a jingle and looked past Ilya Sanguinati. Aggie stood on the other side of the screen door. I thought I'd seen her on the porch a few minutes ago, but she was gone by the time I walked across the kitchen. A gust of wind rattled the house. I started adding things up and wished I had my little calculator handy because there was a lot to add. The siren sounded so loud now, I pictured Grimshaw driving right through the front of the house like one of the cops had done in a recent TV show. A car door slammed. Then another door slammed. Then someone, or something, growled as it headed toward the kitchen.
Vicky?
Miss Devine?
Add one crow, one angry attorney, one police officer, one bookstore-owning friend, a second gust of wind that might be an opinion, and one panther that entered the kitchen just ahead of the two men. I'll call you back. I hung up on Inike and considered the variety of upset males filling up my kitchen and staring at my face. Oh, crap. Crappity crap crap.
What happened?
Officer Grimshaw asked at the same time Julian said,
You need a doctor.
I don't need a doctor, and nothing happened, I replied. Ilya Sanguinati hissed. Cougar growled. Julian made a huffing sound that might have been an angry laugh. Grimshaw said nothing. Somehow, that made him the scariest one of all.
Nothing happened, Julian said. What? You walked into a door? Do you know how many times police officers hear that excuse?
Double crappity crap crap. Aggie had eased into the kitchen and worked her way around all the male bodies until she stood next to me. She took my hand, gently. That told me who had blabbed Ilya and Cougar. But who had said what to Julian and Grimshaw that had them tearing up here right on the other's heels? Suddenly, feeling tired and achy, I pulled out a kitchen chair and sat. Then I sighed. I had a very weird, very scary dream, and when I tried to get away from the gauze-headed monster, I fell out of bed and scraped my head on the bedside table. It's embarrassing, and it's nothing to fuss about.
You have a blackberry toe,
Aggie said, pointing at my left foot. We all looked at my big toe, most of which was a solid purple-black. Huh, I thought that was a shadow. I hadn't turned on the bathroom light when I'd taken a shower, figuring the dim morning light was sufficient, and a lot less upsetting when I could look at my face and pretend I was seeing shadows and not bruises.
You need to see a doctor, Grimshaw insisted.
I agree, Ilya Sanguinati said. No. I was firm about that, despite my ribs starting to clamp around my lungs in response to male voices that were too loud to be safe. But I was firm until...
Womp.
I'd always thought my thighs were chunky, but I couldn't see me under Cougar's paw. It was a big paw, and when he wrinkled his lips and showed me his teeth, I noticed that they were a perfect set of cat teeth. Not a misplaced human tooth among them. I should have been intimidated. Gods, I should have been terrified. Maybe I would have been if Cougar had growled at me. But he was one of the boys here at the jumble, and while it wouldn't be smart to trust him not to mistake me for lunch if I was actively bleeding, the paw on my thigh felt oddly comforting, like it was his way of telling me it was safe to stop and think. All right. I'll go to the doctor's. But I don't want to ride in the police car. I sounded like a whiny 6-year-old, but I didn't care. I'd had enough of riding in cop cars, and I could feel the anxiety attack starting again, just waiting for the final push. Focused on my breathing in an effort to avoid the meltdown, I almost missed the significant looks between Grimshaw and Ilya Sanguinati.
Fine, Grimshaw said. Julian can drive you.
Happy to, Julian said. Ilya shook his head. My car is on the way. I will escort Victoria to the doctor. He focused on Aggie for a moment. But perhaps we can all meet up after the doctor's visit?
At the boarding house? Julian suggested. I can call Inike and see if she can provide lunch.
Can I say something? I raised my hand halfway, which was childish or snarky, hard to tell at that point.
Of course, Grimshaw said smoothly, as he removed a small notebook and pen from his shirt pocket. You can describe your dream. Anything that frightened you that much could have relevance to the investigation.
I stared at him. How? I'm not an intuit or a blood prophet. I was pretty sure asking me to describe the dream was his way of getting back at me for being snarky. But now that he's tossed that idea out there, I could see that they all wanted details. More embarrassed than ever, I grumbled. It was just a silly dream. Have you seen any papier-mâché creatures in business suits running around sproing?
The creature could be symbolic, since paper seems to be at the center of your current difficulties. Julian said, frowning. And this dream might be trying to tell you that you understand more about what is going on than you realize. I wanted to punch Julian for validating the dream, but I would have needed to push Cougar's paw off my leg in order to stand up, and I didn't think I'd succeed. So I described in excruciating detail, because 3 of the 4 males in the kitchen kept interrupting to ask for more details. The dream that had caused my various bumps and bruises when my sleeping body obeyed my fuzzy brain and tried to run away without having any clue about its current location. Stupid body. Stupider brain for not posting a sign that said, "Dream threat, please ignore." Of course, even surrounded by guns and fangs, the image of the gauze-headed monster made me want to run. So maybe my various parts, while misguided, weren't all that stupid. After all, running away was a valid choice. Which meant Julian might be right about my subconscious trying to tell me something important.
The car is here, Ilya said.
You need your purse?
Julian asked. Of course I needed my purse.
I can get it. You sit.
Julian disappeared, moving as if he were familiar with the main house and knew how to find my suite of rooms. I was trying to think of how to tell the two men who were so obviously trying not to look like they were wondering if Julian and I were friends or friends that I wouldn't consider thinking of Julian like that. He was human, and he was my friend, not a romantic fantasy.